This program is supported by a grant from Seagate Technology. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers, and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information is at Seagate.com. It is Friday, April 25th, 2003, 10:04 a.m. on the Central Coast. It's time for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. This morning on Geek Speak, we'll be talking about designing chips, specifically analog integrated circuit design, with Paul McGrath of... Now, I've forgotten the company. How horrible is that? Of Mixed Systems... Mixed Signal Systems of Scotts Valley. During the second half of the show, we'll be taking your calls. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'll be giving out those numbers again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are Geeks Miles, Elam, Dee Dee Hubbard, John Tracy. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thanks, Lyle.
Good morning, Lyle. Good morning.
News, Miles, got anything?
Yeah, got a couple items. One is that apparently online news organizations, like, say, New York Times Online, like, are making money as opposed to losing money. Where in the past they had multi-million dollar losses, now we're starting to see multi-million dollar gains and profits from it. And they're finding that more and more people are viewing news online rather than getting a newspaper or getting it from other sources. And
how are they making money? Are they charging?
Through advertising, just as newspapers do. Okay. For the most part. You have some people may pay for newspapers, but really the money is from the advertisers. On the papers themselves, and they've gotten their processes down on their websites too.
So we're kind of made full circle where people are actually making money on advertising on websites.
Yeah, and many journalists, when polled, are saying that they expect online journalism to become even more prevalent in as a major news outlet.
Great, great. All right, next on the news. That's a very appropriate news item, by the way. News on the internet. Dee Dee, you got something?
Back in digital video recording.
You know, Dee Dee, can you, are you at mic 4 or mic 5? Let's see if we can get closer. Go ahead and just get closer to that mic.
JVC just announced...
Now, go ahead and use Miles' mic there. Swing it over.
JVC announces the GRHD1, world's first consumer high-definition recorder, available probably in Japan in March, and earlier, and coming in around $2,500. It's announced that it will record to MPEG-2 for higher definition quality versus the current DV standard, and it's the first camera that's been marketed toward the consumer market.
Now, and this is a video camera?
Yeah.
I mean, this is a...
Digital video
camera. And it does HDTV.
Well,
is the biggest thing about it?
High definition, lots of colors, big resolution, essentially.
And who's making it?
JVC.
JVC, okay. Yeah, Sharon the mic. Go ahead and swing it back over.
A recent study was done on where spammers get your email address. I'm sure a lot of people want to know exactly where they're getting it from. Number one place that people find your email address is when you put it onto a website. If your email address is on a website, chances are it's on a spammer's email list. Second place was on Usenet news groups, although that was a very distant second. When we talk about the address was posted on the public web, that was a probably close to about 2/3 of all email addresses are grabbed from a website.
So Miles,
How should you do that on a website then? If you have a website and you want to put a way for people to contact you?
Well, if you're just using that website, in general, avoid putting, if you know that the email address is going to be listed, just don't put it in the first place.
It's Can you do an email with a Mail-To link? You know, email me here?
No, because actually the Mail-To link is what the spider will be reading. What really needs to be done is for the webmaster, the web author, to write into their web pages a way of obfuscating the email, a way of making the email address not readable by human beings, doing HTML encoding or just doing things like, instead of writing out the actual email address, actually writing out Miles at, and instead of having the at sign, have the word at, at.
Actually, one trick I've seen a lot of sites use is where they actually have their, when they want to put their email address, they have an image. They have a GIF image that is their email address, so that won't be spidered by anything, but actual people can read it and type it in.
Except that that violates accessibility rules, and people who are blind will be able to access it. But yes, that is one way of doing it.
And that was Chris Dunphy, who just joined us. Thanks for joining us, Chris. The other way to do it, of course, well, just to basically do obfuscation on your email address, other ways to do it is to, you know, say, well, the ISP that I use is yahoo.com, and my username on yahoo.com is blah. And that is pretty hard. It's English, basically, so it's hard for programs to figure out. But if you just do your email address and you change the at symbol to the word at with spaces, most spiders are smart enough to actually put that back together.
Well, what this study actually found was even that minimum level of obfuscation was sufficient to keep a spider from getting it. The vast majority of spiders, apparently, are the ones that are grabbing these and harvesting those email addresses, are extremely dumb. They aren't going to the extra effort to try to deobfuscate.
All right, that's good to know. Next on the news.
Cable beats DSL in speed race.
This mic still isn't working, sorry, Dee.
CNET News reports that cable beats DSL in speed race, 50% faster on average than DSL connections. Which is great for all the people on cable broadband.
Does that mean that cable is faster even when it's saturated, or just faster when you're the only person on that channel?
See, that's the benefits of being on a digital subscriber line. It's just you on that line versus cable, which is shared by your neighbors, and you might have a neighbor who likes to download huge fat whatever files at 3 o'clock in the morning when you want to check your email and yeah.
And, of course, technically a DSL connection, DSL is actually kind of like a hub situation from at the central location, at the central office where it actually your line goes to. So there's still going to be a bandwidth issue if everybody on that subscriber line service connects at the same time.
Most
technically.
Likely.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so people are saying that cable might be even faster. I can't get either, so
average.
It doesn't matter to me. So go. What else we got? John's got something? Or no, go ahead, Miles. We're doing technical difficulties all around us today. So.
The Matrix movies, Matrix Reloaded and Matrix Revolutions. When Matrix Reloaded is released, 2 or 3 weeks after that, the IMAX version will be released to theaters, to IMAX theaters, that is. And it's been announced that Matrix Revolutions, the third movie in the series, will be released on IMAX and standard theaters at the same time. So those of you who have seen IMAX movies, imagine seeing The Matrix on that immersive screen or that panoramic screen.
Can we go get in line now?
any other news items before we go on to our? I think we'll cut it short and go on to our topic at hand. When you hear about chips or ICs, chances are you're hearing about processors. Intel, Motorola, AMD, and others design processors which are the heart of a computer, but microprocessors are only a small fraction of the chip industry. Other ICs, or integrated circuits, are used for a myriad of things. Memory, small sensors, communication devices, controllers, amplifiers, you name it. And there's probably an IC that you can buy that does it, or a company you can go to have that design manufactured for you. Basically, an IC is a microscopic electronic circuit encased in a plastic die with two or more wires coming out. You have to supply power to them, and then you can use the circuit within. Paul McGrath holds a Bachelor's of Science in Electrical Engineering from Lancaster University in England and has been designing analog and mixed signal ICs for 17 years. He moved to Santa Cruz in 1990 and has been working for Mixed Signal Systems, Inc., MS2.net, if you're interested, of Scotts Valley since 1996. Paul, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
And we had a chance because we were here. You brought in some of the circuit designs and the chips and actually got to take a look at the mapping and how it's laid out. Basically, these small things the size of a pinky fingernail blown up to, well, 4 or 5 feet. And it still looks really complicated. So let's start by the first thing you do in designing a circuit is going to the paper route of actually designing the electrical circuit, which is just on paper.
Yes, correct.
Or on a computer, really, that you then print out.
Yeah, I mean, from the customer, they give us a specification in terms of what they want the device to do. And they're mainly concerned with what goes in the chip and what comes out of it. They're not really concerned with what's inside it, and that's our job. So we take their specification and design circuits to meet those specifications and guarantee the performance of that device over various process parameters and over various environmental conditions like temperature, for example. So there are plenty of design challenges.
Okay. Now, what is the kind of request that you get from a company?
The kind of request we get is for a device to handle data at a certain rate and the signal levels that would be applied to that device. And often those signal levels will be fairly small and embedded in noise. And our device will have to detect those signals and amplify them and make sense of those signals and often process it in the analog realm and make it into a nice, clean digital signal for the next chip down the line.
Because we do live in an analog world where the physics are actually happening in an analog realm. Even though we like to say that digital's happening all the time, there's actually
exactly.
A crossover point where it's difficult.
Exactly. And a lot of people believe that digital is taking over the analog, and that is true to a certain extent, but the boom in digital electronics has also boosted the need for analog electronics as well. Like, I imagine the digital realm as being like a sphere and the analog realm as being the skin on that sphere that allows the digital circuitry to communicate with the
okay.
real world.
Well, let's go into a real-world scenario. You were showing us a chip that is basically, for all you geeks out there, a multiplexer. It takes your 10 gigahertz fiber optic information, locks to that,
exactly.
and splits it into multiple 16-channel output at a digital
exactly.
level. Okay. And what is, I mean, that chip was multiple. I mean, how many leads are on that chip?
It's about 80-pin lead.
80-pin. So there's 80 little wires coming out.
Exactly.
And this is a surface
yep.
mount thing, which means that, and pretty much all stuff now is surface mount. There's no, the chip doesn't actually have pins that go through the board. It just
yep.
lays on top and through a heat process melts the solder and connects those leads right to the chip.
Correct.
If you open up your computer, you see these things all over the place.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's true.
So we hear about fiber optics all the time. They have a lot of bandwidth. Does in high speed, I'm assuming, means bandwidth? Is that what the 10
yes.
gigahertz really?
Yeah, in terms of how much data you can transmit down that channel, at what rate. So a fiber optic, they'll transmit at the speed of light, so they're going at the same speed in that sense. But a high-speed circuit basically can chop the data into smaller and smaller time increments. So for 10 gigabits per second, each data cell is actually 100 picoseconds long. So it enables you to transmit so much more data in a shorter period of time.
And a picosecond is a very small fraction of a second, meaning a millionth? 10,000.
A picosecond is 1,000th of a millionth of a second.
1,000th of a millionth. Okay. So really
actually,
small.
It's a 1,000th time smaller than that.
Okay.
1,000th of a millionth is a nanosecond, and a picosecond is 1,000th time smaller than that.
So a trillionth of a second.
Yeah, exactly. So to give you some perspective, a 10 gigabit channel could translate all the data of a CD-ROM in about half a second.
Okay.
So that would be 10 gigabits per second.
All right.
And they need those kind of data rates in backbones for the Internet. So everybody's emails gets channeled into one of these channels that goes across country or...
And then what's the purpose of splitting that 10 gigabit fat pipe, as it's called in bandwidth of fat pipe, into 16 channels? Is that 16 division something that's kind of a standard?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. That allows the... I mean, only the fiber optic can transmit data at that rate, and to allow it to be transmitted down copper, then it needs to be demultiplexed to a lower data rate, to 16 channels of 622 megabits per second, and that's...
And then that's the copper realm, and the copper
exactly.
can take care of it from there, which
exactly.
is an easier process to deal with, because you don't have to deal with this locking onto that high-frequency signal, and that's why we don't have fiber optics inside our computers, for example. It's much easier.
We don't today, but we probably will do sometime in the future.
Okay.
And they are trying to get fiber optics to the home, and that's one of the chips.
And that means a lot more analog-digital stuff is going to be happening.
Exactly, and I mean, even like a CD player, which we think of as digital music, and it is a digital system, that still has analog requirements from the laser pickup there are many non-linearities in that, and that the speed of the disk isn't perfect, and the distance from the disk to the laser isn't perfect. So you need analog circuitry to pick that signal
to
up.
To focus that laser beam and
exactly.
to get the, make sure you've locked on the signal.
And to pull that signal from the noise and to make it a nice, clean digital signal for the digital processing to follow.
And everyone that's listening right now, well, those of you that are on FM and not listening to us through KOSP.org, through streaming, you are listening to the information that you're getting right now has a lot of the similarities to what we're talking about in the fiber optic realm, where KOSP is transmitting our conversation up to our main transmitter, and our main transmitter then transmits it via FM. And FM, you have to have a radio that actually locks to the FM the signal on the FM carrier, and has to have a lock, and has to have a feedback loop, and it has to keep that lock. And if it doesn't, then you won't hear the sound at all. It's very different than AM. But in any case, that kind of process is very similar to what your chip does with the 10 gigabit line on the fiber optics. Is that right?
That is true, yeah. Yeah, okay. Yeah. The FM radio has a local oscillator which runs at the same rate as the FM is being transmitted, and this 10 gigabit channel has a local oscillator that locks onto the signal coming
down
the fiber.
So you've basically got a clock in there that's running at 10 gigahertz, and you then need to actually sync those a little bit.
Exactly.
Even more. How do you sync those?
It detects the data coming through and uses a phase lock loop to change the frequency of the on-chip oscillator until it matches the data perfectly.
Pretty much exactly like an FM receiver
yeah,
does.
Yeah,
okay.
That's true.
Well, that's great. I'm sure that we've lost most people. I think even some of the geeks in the room are following it partially. And I got to say, Paul, I love it. Just eating it up. Hope other people are. You are listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. We are talking about integrated circuit design with Paul McGrath of Mixed Signal Systems, Inc.
That's
of
right.
Scotts Valley. www.ms2.net. Paul, when you're dealing with... Let's talk about the actual split up of... I know we're talking a lot about the technology behind
okay,
it rather
right.
than the actual details of how you make a chip. So let's switch over
sure.
to that chip manufacturing process. You make a circuit, which is the basics of what you want to put on the chip. And it's basically a mapping of what... of the logical flow of the data or of the signals.
Yeah, I mean, there are a huge number of engineers involved in the whole process. Like, there are the process engineers that design and create the silicon process itself, which give us, the circuit design engineers, a great array of fantastic performing transistors and...
Resistors and everything
and
you need to build your process.
And every few years, they give us a new process that gives us even faster performance. So what we have as circuit designers is a whole bag of different resistors and transistors to pick and connect however we want on the silicon surface to create the function we need.
So the company, the group that makes the processing technology, there's an engineering core that then gives you the library of the process,
exactly.
the stuff that can be on that chip, the transistors, all those things.
Yeah, the mathematical model of each component.
And tested? Do they test those for its accuracy?
They do test and model what those transistors and resistors do, and we have mathematical models of those, and that allows us to create a virtual circuit on the computer, and we use UltraSpark workstations. Which allows us to build that circuit in the computer's memory to see whether the performance of that circuit will do what we expect before
now,
we actually manufacture it.
Now, why do you have to simulate in a computer rather than just going, well, a resistor does, I mean, a resistor reduces the flow and or you know does the step down of voltage and then transistor, you know, I mean, why can't you act kind of like a switch? But why can't you just use that and just know that it's going to work? Why do you have to model it?
Because I'm not that clever. the interaction of all these components on a chip is very complex, and you do some work on paper in terms of calculations, but it soon gets out of hand, and you need to have a high degree of confidence that the circuit's going to do what you want.
So is it more than just what the circuit does? It's actually what the components do independently of what your circuit design is. I mean, the components are interacting with each other in different
exactly.
ways.
I mean,
other than the...
I mean, for example, just for that chip I showed you earlier, a very small part of that chip would be an amplifier, which would contain perhaps 20 or 30 devices, and that's like 1% or less than 1% of that chip. And that amplifier will have to work over various conditions, various input levels, and achieve the level of performance required. And by simulating you get a fairly quick answer of whether that circuit that you've come up with will work or not.
Now, and you can simulate even the temperature variances? Like
absolutely. Temperature variations and imperfections in the silicon in terms of, like, not every single chip is exactly the same. Ideally, they are. But from chip to chip, the resistors vary, for example, or the speed of the transistors vary, and we have to simulate those various parameters.
What happens if you didn't have a simulator? How would your business work? Wouldn't it not work?
Well, this business, what we do, was done years ago without computers, and it was just a hell of a lot slower, and the chips were a hell of a lot simpler,
okay,
and more mistakes were made. So
more testing, actually.
More testing, and you'd have to go through more generations of devices and designs before you got the design working. So hopefully, with a good simulator and a good design, the very first chip that comes out of the manufacturer
works
the first time. Now that doesn't always happen, but it happens a lot of the time.
Are you spending a lot of money for these simulators, or are they provided by the
That's probably our biggest cost, is the actual software we use. It's about $100,000 per seat for the actual tools that we use.
Now, mixed signal systems, even though you're doing really complicated stuff, you've got six people doing it?
That's correct, yes.
So $600,000 for simulations, that's some money.
Yeah, it's pretty expensive.
Good to know. let's go to, so you design the thing, you simulate it, you make sure that in the simulation it's going to work, you go back to redesign a lot, and I'm assuming your whole team is kind of working on a whole bunch of parts of this.
Yes, yeah, everybody at MS2 are engineers, and we all share in the process of creation of the circuits and layout of the circuits.
So you normally work on one project at a time? Or
We normally have our own responsibility for each project, but we're always helping each other on various projects, and like when the deadline nears, we will help each other out, so it's a really good team effort.
It sounds like a great team effort.
Yeah, it's a very good.
And it's very complex.
Speaking of deadlines, how long does it take to design a chip?
It varies very much in terms of the chip complexity, but usually our time scale is like in the region of, like, I'd say 3 months at the minimum to, like, 9 months to maybe a year for the most complex devices we do.
And so the multiplexer, was that...
That I think that was a while ago now, but I think the timescale for that was about 10 months or something.
Now, are you seeing the technologies available on the chip change over time?
Yes, absolutely. Like the technology we use now, we use high-speed BiCMOS technology, which allows us to use bipolar and CMOS transistors on chip. And the processes today are much better than they were 5 years ago. And the process engineers create better and better technologies every few years, and that gives us more work to do as engineers. So
now, when I always talked about MOSFETs, I'm always talking about the outside of the chip, what its inductance level is because of MOSFET's great inductance ability. But it's much more than that. The entire, if you're doing MOSFET, for example, just MOSFET, the entire wafer process is supporting MOSFET transistors, and there might not be a support for other transistors on that same chip.
What exactly is a MOSFET? Have we already gone over this?
All right, let's jump back to that. Yeah, that's true, John. Thank you.
Or am I too late to start asking for definitions now?
A transistor called a MOSFET.
Okay.
What is it?
There are two mainstream types of transistors. One is the MOSFET, and that's a field effect transistor, which basically, when electrical voltage is applied to the controlling input to that chip, to that transistor, it creates a field that allows a conducting channel through that transistor. So, in simple terms, it changes the resistance of that silicon, which allows it to conduct electricity or not. And
so that's where the term semiconductor comes from?
Yes. And that also applies the term semiconductor to bipolar transistors, which are a bit more of an old-fashioned transistor, but they're still very useful, and that uses a current multiplying effect.
Now, what does that mean, with current multiplying? I mean, what?
Like, for example, in a bipolar transistor, you apply a small amount of current to the base, and you get a much larger amount of current through the collector and the emitter.
So those are basically two types of transistors?
Two types of transistors.
One just amplifies your base voltage, and one acts much more like a switch, that it produces a field that then allows current flow.
Yes, and both of those transistors can be used for various functions, and there's crossover functions between the two. And CMOS or MOSFET transistors are very suitable for digital circuitry. They're really good for high speed, low power switching, and bipolar is good for very good matching or higher gain circuits. But CMOS is getting cheaper and cheaper, and they're getting more and more transistors on chips, so there's a lot of pressure to achieve more and more functions with CMOS, even though it's more difficult. So that's where a lot of the challenge is in the future.
Now, so why is the move towards CMOS? What's the
reason for it? CMOS is basically the digital process, and there's so much more silicon being pushed through in terms of digital circuits.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the price of CMOS is coming down and down, and if you can put the analog circuitry on the same process as the digital circuitry, then you've got a very cost-effective solution.
Now, that analog transistor, the bipolar transistor, which I'm more familiar of, is it pretty much when you're dealing with analog technology, you need to use that because it does have the varying levels, and the MOSFET actually does a switching?
Generally, it's easier to design analog circuitries with bipolar, but saying that, there's always
a way to do it.
There's always ways to do it, and some analog functions are more suitable for CMOS as well. But generally, for amplifiers and where you want high gain and good speed, bipolar is usually the easiest way to achieve
okay.
those functions.
Now, you don't have a manufacturing plant to actually
no.
make chips. So what happens after you... Actually, in just a minute, we'll get back to what happens after you get the design, after you get it analyzed with your computer systems, and
sure.
then you go off to make some chips. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are geeks Didi, Miles, Sean... Sorry. Didi, Miles, John, and Chris Dunphy. We are talking about integrated circuit design with Paul McGrath of Mixed System Signal Systems, Inc., Scotts Valley. That sure is getting me a tongue tie. We invite your questions and comments about integrated circuit design or anything related to technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. This program is supported by Seagate. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information is at Seagate.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio KSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. You're listening to Geek Speak. In the air room with me, John Tracy, Miles Elam, Didi Hubbard, Chris Dunphy, and of course our guest, Paul McGrath. We await your questions and comments about ICs or computer problems and dilemmas. We can handle Windows, Linux, website creation, Macintosh. Gosh, we can handle anything. Networking.
Palm.
Yeah, that's right. The numbers are 476-2800. Or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing internet services, including DSL and spam filters, for home and office throughout Santa Cruz County. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. And the phone numbers to join GeekSpeak, 476-2800. Toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'm Lyle Troxell, and we're back with our discussion about ICs. Paul, we just were about to talk about. So, you design the chip, you test it, you.
Well, what we do is we basically design the device, and our end product is basically a bunch of data that we send to our manufacturer. So they take that information and manufacture the actual IC.
And that's the whole process we've kind of heard about before, where you have this stack of silicon and these wafers,
exactly.
and then you etch and you put material on top of them and basically build what you've designed.
Yeah, exactly. So that goes through that magic process, and a few months later, that the actual silicon chips come back to us.
How many do you get?
We usually get in the region of just like 10 to 15 to just do initial evaluation. And in the laboratory, we have at Mixed Signal Systems, we run various signals through that device and see if it's working the way we expect it to work. And hopefully it does.
And how frequently does it?
I'd say most of the time, 90% plus, we get good functionality and good performance compared with the simulator and with what we expect. So most of the time, the matching and the designs work as well as expected, which is much better than it was a few years ago.
Yeah, it's definitely what you want.
Exactly.
Now, is that whole test phase of making, 10 or 15 chips, is that pretty expensive?
It's very expensive. The cost with making the actual wafers and the optical plans for creating those wafers is very expensive. Each actual individual chip itself is fairly cheap. It's just the tooling.
Do you get to use that tooling if you have no errors at all? You get to use that tooling again to make your run?
Oh, if there's nothing wrong with it, yes, that can go straight into production.
Now, do you normally order the run, or do you just say, well, here's the data that worked, go ahead and company that purchased or that asked us to make this project, that paid for us to make this project, you go ahead and make whoever processes.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much up to the customer then what they do with that design.
But they probably would go, if you've already run a test batch that worked, they'll probably go to that same company so they can use the same dies, or do you own
exactly.
those dies at that point?
The customer owns those. They pretty much pay for our engineering time and our engineering expertise.
Nice.
And the customer owns the silicon.
From Santa Cruz, Stephen, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you. I wanted to ask your guest to gaze into his crystal ball for the moment. It sounds like he's very involved in present research and development. But looking towards the future, a couple of related questions. One is regarding the ultimate physical limit of silicon integrated circuit manufacturing. I see numbers of a fifth of a micron or an eighth of a micron or a tenth of a micron being the physical limit of the essentially wiring that you can use when you hook up these transistors that you build into the various layers of silicon when you're making a chip. One question is, at what point does that just become impossible to do with the optical process of reducing wires down small? And then secondly, can you answer a question about where we're going next? Is it molecular computers? Is it organic materials being made, being used to manufacture chips instead of silicon? And where's that going in the future? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you very much. Very interesting questions. And to tell you the truth, what they're doing with the silicon technology even blows me away. The level of technology always surprises me what can be done. And the integration they're achieving in the laboratories today, I probably won't be designing with until the next 4 or 5 years. So I don't see an end to the development so far, or at least the small sizes they're dealing with now, like very small fractions of a micron, that allows great improvement in the circuits. Even if those developments stopped in the research laboratories today, that gives us plenty more years to develop even more complex circuits than what we see today. And
complex is good in circuit design?
Yeah, complex allows you to achieve more functionality and the circuits to be smart and do more intelligent things like voice recognition. I think that's going to be fairly common in our devices in the future. And I think you're right, there probably will be chips made with molecular technology in the future. So I still think there's a long way to go with...
Chips are made right now with molecules. So what is molecular technology?
Well, I mean, like,
where's that line?
Organic. Using like neural network type of arrangements, or more like a nanotechnology where the transistors are built up on the atomic level.
So you build them up rather than having a substrate that you etch away. Instead, you build them, you compile them upwards like life does.
Yeah, okay. yeah, to a large extent like that. So right. So I'm looking forward to working with that kind of technology in the future, and I think there's a much more growth in it that's available. I think. There's going to be a lot more intelligence applied to or in the systems and the electronics that we have in the future.
Okay. Now we always hear about molecular nanotechnology and all these special things, but what's happening like recently that's actually blowing you, amazing you in the last 17 years? What have you seen recently that is impressive in chip manufacturing?
Well, in terms of what I work with, just in terms of the performance of the transistors and such, but what's happening in the marketplace, for example, the great improvements in digital photography, that changed much faster than I expected. It just seemed a few years ago they were fairly basic, and I thought it'd be quite a few years before digital cameras were as good as film, and it's just taken a very small number of years before they've surpassed film, and I think film is pretty much obsolete to a large extent for a lot of users.
Strong statement, yeah. You were showing us a chip that you made in integration with in development with a company that was creating the process of growing kind of an inductor on top of the chip surface.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that was with actual Xerox, and they used nanotechnology to create an inductor that springs off the surface of the chip and forms a 3D inductor that actually sits on top of the device. And they actually have a video of it curling off the chip and connecting itself together, which is pretty amazing.
An inductor is basically a coil of wires that interact with each other, and it impedes flow of current.
Exactly.
Or it impedes change of the flow of current.
Yes.
And those are, you need inductors, the basic components of making chips that you use. Transistor, capacitor.
The basic components are transistors and resistors, that they're the main components of our chips, and we also use capacitors and inductors. Inductors are fairly new, actually, in the last few years in ICs, to actually have on-chip inductors.
Now, a capacitor is kind of the reverse electronically of an inductor. Can you explain that?
A capacitor is like the equivalent of a spring in the electrical world. It allows a kind of squeezed storage of electrical energy, and the equivalent of an inductor is like a electrical mass. And if you put a spring and a mass together, you can get it to vibrate. And so often we use a combination of a capacitor and inductor to create an oscillator. And
that's what you're using on this chip to make that 10 gigahertz clock oscillator.
Exactly. So we have a very small inductor, a very small capacitor, and this oscillator runs at 10 gigahertz.
You're listening to Geek Speak, and my goodness, it's geeky today. My name is Lyle Troxell. The geeks in the room, Dee Dee, Miles, Chris, and John, we're talking with Paul McGrath. And we're talking about ICs, but that shouldn't stop you from calling up and asking any kind of questions you want. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Go ahead and ask a question with this kind of level of geekiness. It'll bring us back down to earth, which would probably be very useful to most people that are listening. Again, the phone number is 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Geeks in the house, you have any questions for Paul?
I actually have a question. One of the holy grails as far as analog and digital converging is software-defined radio, what's being referred to as 4G radio networks, where one chip can tune into any different type of over-the-air radio network, whether it be 802.11 or Bluetooth or CDMA or GPRS. Now, I was wondering if you could talk about the challenges that would be involved in creating something like that.
Well, to tell you the truth, I'm not really a software expert, but if any of those companies that wanted to do a software-defined radio asked us to do a chip, we'd be very interested.
So in that situation, you're talking about basically a really complex chip that would have multiple circuitry that would tune to the different frequencies. So you're basically having multiple radios. It would be basic, from my basic understanding of electronics, it would be multiple radios on one chip that then gets switched to or changed frequencies.
Yeah.
Based off of software.
I mean, probably the biggest difference between that and a normal radio would be in the digital processing side of things. And we're not normally involved in that. The digital processing side of things is like tens or hundreds of thousands of gates, and we do mainly the analog front end. So in terms of the receiver design and the initial processing, it would probably be fairly similar to conventional radio technology to a large extent.
But you might have just multiple circuitries on the same chip.
Exactly, yeah.
And do you ever do a situation where a company really wants what Chris was just defining, which is kind of a multi-spectrum radio transceiver that could be used for a whole bunch of different wireless technologies, okay, and they want it in one chip. So they go to you because you're an analog expert, and you say, well, we're not going to be able to do the digital aspect, so can you make half a chip and then send it off to somebody
else?
Exactly.
We do that plenty of times. I mean, a customer will ask us to design a portion of that chip, maybe 5 or 10% of it, or the whole chip. So we will design a particular cell to fit in with their system, and a large part of that chip will be a digital processor or a digital signal processor. And we won't be that familiar with that circuit. We just need to know what we need to deliver to them on the chip. And
so then they can take those millions of gates and go forward from there.
Yeah, exactly.
So you do see some of your circuits just kind of embedded in a large. In that situation,
yes.
It'd be like. You're barely part of the silicon, but you're there.
Yeah, exactly.
An important role.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's fascinating.
I was just wondering, what keeps you, or inspires you to do analog versus digital, since there's a huge digital push? Like, why are you an analog digital mixed signal engineer versus?
Good question. I'm very much more interested in the physical side of things, the physics, and I really liked physics at university. And just playing with the amplifiers and working with the voltage levels and currents, I find much more interesting. And anybody who's interested in being an engineer, the analog side is more closely tied to the physics of the silicon itself. And if you're interested in the physics of things, then maybe analog electronics is for you. And if you're more in the programming computer side of things, then you could design, or you may be more interested in designing the digital side. And even though there is a huge push for everything being pushed digital, there is a shortage of analog design engineers, which is good news for people like me.
Good news for your whole entire business.
Exactly.
I've always kind of seen analog engineers, having been on the digital side, that it's kind of like a voodoo, mysterious science. And actually, it's always struck me as actually almost more art than science. And I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Yes, it's often described as a black art, and we'll call it a black art if something doesn't work the way we expect. So that's always fun. But there are many more unknowns in the analog realm. Like, to a large extent, the digital design has been automated to a large extent, and the design process is fairly separate from the silicon, but we have to get in the nitty-gritty, and there are many more imperfections in terms of the design process, like noise across the device and mismatch between devices and such.
Let's talk about that conceptual perfection circuit versus with the reality, which is those imperfections in the technology.
Comparing the simulation to the silicon, yes.
Yeah, when you're not in the simulations, even the simulation takes into account some of the imperfections that are going on. So before that, when you've got your circuit that theoretically should work, you know that all these things are kind of variable. And I mean, does that knowledge something you learn in school, or is that knowledge something you have to learn working with circuits?
Pretty much learn it with working with the circuits themselves. Actually designing the circuits gives you a lot of experience. And I mean, what I learned at school and at university is pretty much just the basics of how a transistor can work and the most basic amplifier. But when you're actually designing these circuits, you get to really get a feel for what the process does and what the challenges involve in actually creating a circuit that really works.
And when in learning electronics, you kind of get the idea that a schematic is this kind of perfect situation which never really exists. But you can most of the time ignore it if you're not pushing it too close to the tolerances. You can go, well, logically this circuit is perfect, it's going to work, and then, well, we're going to have some... But you don't really you don't worry about that when you're designing your circuit normally. So you really have to worry about that aspect, that it's not...
We do.
And that's the art. I mean, that's the part that becomes kind of an art.
Because the customers, what they want us to do, they want us to push the technology as fast as it can possibly go, so we're always working at that edge of as getting as much out of the silicon as possible. So that means pushing it as far to almost failing as possible, but still getting the performance. So we're very rarely working at a low enough frequency where everything is guaranteed to work. So we're always working at the edge of what the technology can do.
And the reason why you get those projects is because those are the projects that you need. I mean, people need you for.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
If people want to call in, we're listening to Geek Speak. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. You can call and ask questions about your computer, about any type of computer, any kind of technology. We'll have some kind of opinion. Again, the phone number is 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Paul, let's talk about the tolerances. Some of the variables are pretty easy to understand. So a resistor resists the flow of current, resists the voltage. Current. And it has a rating of a certain amount, which is called ohms.
Yes.
And even though you ask for, let's say, a 250-ohm resistor, which is huge, you might not get that perfection.
Exactly. Like, ideally, every single chip that comes out the factory is exactly the same, but in reality, there will be variations in terms of the chip performance, and resistors could vary by plus or minus 20%, for example.
Well, that's a lot.
Yeah, exactly. And the transistor speeds can vary by plus or minus 10%. And the capacitor can vary plus or minus.
Is that kind of universal against all chip manufacturing processes?
All chip manufacturing processes suffer from variations. There's no perfect process out there. And some processes are tighter than others. And
what causes those variants? Why isn't it a perfect process?
A large number of things, like the actual silicon structure itself. There can be variations in terms of the doping levels, like the doping levels of the boron that's added to the silicon is not going to be exactly the same across the wafer and from wafer to wafer. And optically, these components are incredibly small, but there's variations in terms of the width of those transistors that are placed down on the wafer and
because
the width of those resistors, for example.
Because again, most of the time you're doing kind of a silk screening technology.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
And you have light hitting a surface, and the surface has molecules, and it's going to vary like any surface.
Yeah.
It's so small we normally consider it a straight line, but that line's actually going to not be straight, and so that kind of stuff causes the imperfections.
And those manufacturing tolerances are in the same in any manufacturing process, whether it's chips or motor cars or whatever.
They always have variants.
They have statistical variations in their processes which they have to handle.
Now this.
And what I just like to say, one of the most difficult things is, if you look at all the different parameters that we have to deal with, there's like 30 parameters on a chip that vary plus or minus 5 or 10%, for example. And if you had to simulate every single one of those, you'd be simulating one of these chips for years. So we have to pick and choose what simulations we have to do and use some judgment.
What kind of variance would really affect your circuit design?
The primary ones are temperature. We have to guarantee the performance of our chips from minus 40 degrees C up to 125 degrees C, for example, and the characteristics of transistors and resistors change a lot over that temperature range, and you have to compensate for that.
We have a phone call from Eric in Salinas. Eric, welcome to GeekSpeak.
How you doing?
Quite well. What's your question, Eric?
Well, my question is just kind of a general question about vacuum tubes. I know lately these days that there's been a lot of audio amplifiers that use the vacuum tubes, and I'm kind of curious about just the way they work, and I've read a little bit about them. But also, in the early 90s, I remember when the MOSFET units started coming out, that a lot of audio amplifiers were claiming that the MOSFET devices had a clipping sort of characteristic that was more similar to the vacuum tubes as opposed to the analog bipolar transistors, which made them more pleasing to the ear. And I'm just wondering if what's your take on vacuum tubes and how they fit in with modern design?
Tell you the truth, I'm not really sure about that, but there are various theories in terms of, and people have their favorites of technology, and I've had many people saying vacuum tubes sound better than transistors. Tell you the truth, I'm not really sure on that one.
I think one of the reasons vacuum tubes are making a comeback in high-end audio is actually just because they look cool.
I think that's probably part of the mystique. You see when they're sitting there glowing, it looks pretty neat.
Exactly, and I just want to say that reminds me of an article I read a while ago that they actually created incredibly small vacuum tubes on chip with using nanotechnology, and they were talking about these vacuum tubes which were more efficient than regular bipolar transistors, so that maybe the vacuum tube would make a comeback in terms of being miniaturized.
That's amazing, I didn't hear about that. That's great.
That's pretty neat. And when you talk about the physics of an analog circuit being kind of more elegant than the digital type circuit, it also holds true from what little I've learned about the vacuum tubes, that the way they work, just inherently there seems like there's a lot more black magic in that than there is with a transistor.
Yes, I mean, I've never actually used a vacuum tube. They went before I ever became an engineer, but they are quite incredible devices themselves.
Addressing the audio, yeah, and they are cool. I mean, you can even see how cool they are by looking at them.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of it comes down, in my opinion, on audio, you know, versus the digital realm and the analog tube technology. It comes down to they're going to produce different sounds. Every sound system produces a different sound.
Sure.
And if you're an audiophile, if you really are into the music, if you really have a great ear, and you've trained yourself to have a great ear, you're going to get used to a sound being a certain way. And if that sound deviates, either, you know, better for, you know, closer to the live performance or farther away from the live performance, you're going to not like it. And that difference when digital was coming out was very pronounced. So people were going, well, my technology sounds better than this technology. And so that kind of started a momentum. But in reality, both of them can sound bad and both of them can sound good.
Oh, sure. It depends a lot on the circuit design.
Yeah. And also design depends on the person listening. So
yeah, this is almost like people talking about different tastes of bottles of wine or something. It's kind of personal.
Right. Well, Eric, thank you very much for the call.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for talking.
And I'd just like to say something in terms of, like, that reminds me of with that last question in terms of valves and cathode ray tubes and such. The cathode ray tube is probably the last tube which is probably going to be made obsolete within the next few years with flat screen TVs. So that's probably the last one to disappear.
Do we have Wes online? Carl, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you. I'm joining the program today.
Wonderful.
We're going from a very high level. I want to sort of ask you a question that goes way back to a very low level, maybe. I'm a teacher, and I would like to be able to go simple measurement tools like temperature, wind direction, things like that, or time, stop, and start, that kind of thing, and go to a computer using it as sort of an analog, I guess, to digital. And I'm wondering, how does somebody find something for somebody that's fairly just has a very rudimentary, basic electronic background? I mean, experience.
So you want to play with sensors on your computer?
Yeah, and I want to be able so that the kids can read them and see what's happening and see it graphed on the computer itself. And I've just been having a hard time trying to find anything that would do that. And I know it used to be pretty simple to do by plugging into the serial port of the old E3s, but we're now up to the G4, and we have a PC XP machine as well. So I'm just wondering what I can use, or is there a site to go to that would explain it?
John, you got something?
Well, if you've got any interest in Legos, I know that Dacta actually carries a whole line of sensors. Dacta is the school version of Legos. They carry a whole line of sensors that hook up to their Mindstorms units, and I know they have light, temperature, and humidity sensors, rotation sensors.
You know, it's
like
interesting.
That.
That's a perfect... I couldn't think of a good situation to surface that kind of stuff to any consumer, but you're right. Lego stuff is great because... And it sounds really much like a toy, but if you look at this new Mindstorm stuff that Lego and DAC are making, you've got a situation where they're taking these stuff that's being used in the field all the time and they're packaging it for the consumer.
Great.
And really wonderful. I agree with John 100% on this. That would be a very easy way to implement... what you want.
Great. Sounds good.
All right.
Thank you.
And I wouldn't be surprised if you search around on that as well, that there'll be companies out there that are using that same interfaces to have graphing programs and of that nature. And I think you can do even scripting stuff with it. So you should be set.
Yeah, the Lego scripting language is really amazing. It's very similar to the one JPL used to program the Mars rover.
They're actually using that at UC Santa Cruz in the embedded circuits design class. Right. Mindstorm robots.
Is that Wes?
What's that? Hello?
Is that Wes, yes?
forgive me, I'm on my way to my geek job right now.
All right, what's your question, Wes?
I have a question about jobs, generally. I once upon a time was headed to be a electronic engineer, just like your guest, but I chickened out and took the easy route and became a software engineer, software geek. And for many years, I have a lot of years' experience in the industry. I was a web guy, and nowadays, you know, I'm doing some little piddly geek job, but I want to get back into the web world, and I can't get a job. And I'm not a person with presentation skills. I interview well, and I'm wondering where are all those jobs? I see jobs advertised occasionally, and though I've never had a problem getting a job before. Now I don't even get the first interview. Are there so many people on the street that I'm competing with amazingly qualified people, or are those jobs really, those recs not really coming through and they're not really hiring people?
Well, Wes, I'd say it's a little bit of both. Anybody else have an opinion on that?
I'm in the same position right now. I'm an independent contractor, but I'm looking for a little more stable work right now, and it's tough out there. Every resume I've sent in, every phone call, every email I've sent has not gone unresponded, but has not led to an actual definite job lead. And one of the reasons is I went to a temp agency just to try it out, and the person saw my resume and said, to be honest, I've got 300 of these on file already. What else can you do? So tech jobs, they're scarce, but I don't know. The uplook, things are looking up. I've seen more lately than I have in the past year.
Yeah, we had a show a while ago about getting a job in the tech industry, and one of the tricks is cold calling. You gotta talk to the person that's actually hiring, and you gotta convince them, and that is very hard to do, even for someone that has, you know, out there a personality that really goes well for that. But the other way to get a job is to find someone that that you know, or someone that you know that you know, someone you know someone that's hiring, and those are the two ways to do it. And responding. Responding in email is not as good as responding in an actual written letter form with a stamp.
Or in person if you can.
Or in person if you can. So good luck on that.
It's a lot easier to ignore an email than it is to ignore a person standing in front of you saying,
please. We are talking with Paul McGrath of Mixed Signal Systems, Inc. You can find out more about Mixed Signal Systems, Inc. by going to www.ms2.net. They're a Scotts Valley company. They've been around since 91.
Yes, that's
correct. Since 91. And it's a company that designs mixed signal ICs.
Devices,
yeah, great. So the name fits pretty well. Paul, do you have anything else you wanted to add to our conversation before we call it a morning?
Just thank you very much for inviting me on the show. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, certainly. Any other geeks have any other questions or anything we want to...
No, Paul, it was great having you on. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Good to see you.
If someone wants to get into the field of what you're doing, what do they need to do in school?
Physics and math are the main ones. And, yeah, stick with it. There's a lot of cool jobs it can lead to.
What level of math do you have to get into? What level of math have you gone into? What do you know? What are you proficient with?
Well, to be quite honest, I've been using the relying on the computer probably too much, so it's kind of easy to forget that stuff, but it's good to have the background. And... I actually study to advanced level mathematics, so that's and we study mathematics at university. So it's all part of the engineering course, actually. I mean, to get through electrical engineering, you have to have a good grasp of the physics and the mathematics.
All right.
And statistics is useful as well.
On a more personal note, why did you move to the U.S.?
The weather, and I think just Santa Cruz is a great place.
Paul McGrath makes integrated circuits for Mixed Signal Systems, Inc. of Scotts Valley. He holds a B.S. in electrical engineering from Lancaster University in England. Paul's an active thespian and a member of the improv theatrical group GM of Santa Cruz County.
And we have a show on the 2nd and 3rd. I have to plug that.
Okay, good. Well, where is it on the 2nd and 3rd?
At the Broadway Playhouse.
All right. And you have a promo. You have something in front of you to read, I believe.
Sure.
Please do, in your improvisational skills.
KUSP co-sponsors the Santa Cruz Chamber Players presenting of Reaching Across the Pond. This concert explores the chamber music of British and American composers of the early 20th century who were passionate about their heritage. There will be two shows, Saturday, April 26th at 8 p.m. at the Light and Life Church, 960 Brummer Street in Santa Cruz, and Sunday, April 27th at 3 p.m. at the St. Andrew Presbyterian Church, 9850 Monroe Avenue in Aptos. For tickets or more information, call 425-3149 or go to scchamberplayers.org.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you.
This is Geek speaking. Paul, thanks for joining us. It's been great. I loved getting back into electronics. I love it when we have electronic stuff on the show. That's my degree, and so it's always fascinating me. But wonderful to have someone that knows their subject so well. Thank you very much. The geeks this morning were Dee Dee Hubbard, John Tracy, Miles Elam, and Chris Dunphy. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. Thank you all for participating in Geek Speak. To those that called in, thank you very much for making Geek Speak what it is without your input. Just be us geeking out, and who wants to listen to that? This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH, San Ardo, on the web at kusp.org. I'm Lyle Troxell. This was Geek Speak. Please stay tuned for Fine Print.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell.